What has music, neon signs, classic cars, and Vegas gangsters in a dramatic story of love and death? Believe it or not, it's the Metropolitan Opera's production of Rigoletto, which we recently checked out in New York.
That's right. In an effort to try something new that we don't usually cover, we visited the historic Opera House. Not only did we see Rigoletto, but we went backstage to see how they make the show happen. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, we are blowing the lid off the Metropolitan Opera, so don't go away.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. With a franchised network of highly trained agents and advanced marketing tools, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services network members aim to provide something more than just real estate. They think beyond the next transaction and build relationships based on your long-term goals to ensure you'll get all the value that home brings, year after year, home after home. All that more they do, that's home services. Start your home search at BerkshireHathawayHS.com.
Welcome back. You just met NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Also with us is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Ciao, Linda.
And for our fourth chair today, we have recruited an actual opera enthusiast. He's currently weekend host on Classical WETA in Washington, D.C., one of the biggest classical music stations in the country. But his real claim to fame is as original Pop Culture Happy Hour panelist Trey Graham. Hey, buddy.
Hey, guys.
So good to see you. Trey is finally getting his opportunity to cover the opera on Pop Culture Happy Hour, as he's always dreamed.
I would just like to say, though, that despite the fact that we are going to talk about the opera for this entire episode, it's still not German Art Song.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's not.
It's true.
Close but no cigar.
Close but no cigar. Stephen Thompson, why don't you explain how this came to be?
Well, careful listeners to Pop Culture Happy Hour will remember that in our New Year's Resolutions and Predictions show, I talked about my desire to get out and experience more culture that I don't necessarily spend time with other people consuming pop culture. And the metric that I gave for that segment was, I will, in 2019, go to the opera. I figured that would be an example of the kind of thing that a cultured person would do. And it turns out that Mary Jo Heath, our new pal.
Our new friend, our new buddy. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hosts the Metropolitan Opera's radio broadcast, is a wonderful host, by the way. And she listens to the show, heard that segment, and had their people reach out and say, we would like to make Stephen's resolution come true. They did not include the words "for once." And so I was like, great, I'm going to go. I'm gonna dress up. We're gonna go out for a night on the town. And then there was an idea. Let's bring the entire Pop Culture Happy Hour crew and experience it all as a group and actually talk about the experience of something that people think of as high culture but don't necessarily know that much about. At least I did not.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about what we actually saw. Rigoletto is a Verdi opera involving several men tangling in a power struggle in which the pawns are mostly women, women's virtue, women's honor, and it ends badly. It has many sad parts. If you are wondering whether it has any of the opera bits that you might know from such things as Saturday Night Live's Opera Man, it has the da, 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 that's Rigoletto.
La donna mobile.
Thank you, Trey. So that is what we saw. They do a lot of operas every year at the Metropolitan Opera. I was surprised. I didn't know how many productions they did every year.
A lot. Hundreds of performances, and I think somewhere in the vicinity of 30 operas
They run them for a relatively short period of time, so they switch them out constantly. And they were kind enough to give us a lengthy backstage tour with our tour guide, Michael, who took us around. And they led us around. We saw the costume shop. We saw the wigs.
The wigs.
We saw the wigs. That's pretty cool.
The scene shop where they were building next season's Dutchman for the Flying Dutchman. The boat. They're building the boat.
With, sparks flying and a metal shop. And a woodworking shop. It's
the
amazing
number of people doing manual labor to make these productions happen. Some of the tricks of the trade, we got to see how they managed to make very ornate wooden sets out of foam so that they can be carried on and off stage quickly.
Yeah. They gave us sort of a little moment to be in the house, the actual, where you sit as the audience, the house itself. itself and explained how they made all of these curved wood pieces from one giant tree.
One 100-foot rosewood tree.
Shocking. It's a very, very beautiful place to be, and we are so grateful that we got to go, but even more grateful that we actually got to see a show. Glenn, talk to me.
Well, just, I mean, that tour with Michael, I mean, Trey knows a lot. Michael knows a lot. So here's how the tour went. Michael.
Oh,
Michael, flah, 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 Trey, well, I think you'll find, flah, 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 flah.
Oh, stop it.
And it's Michael true. Would be like, flah, 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 flah. And just so you guys know, this is Trey, it's just so you guys know, flah, 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 flah.
They're really, you could almost see the feathers.
They were going to throw it out. But this is how you know Michael's an excellent tour guide. Mm. He would just back off.
He would just
be like. He was so good.
It's true.
He was so good.
He was very accommodating to give Trey his space.
Absolutely.
To know way more about opera than we did, even though less than Michael does.
It was so great.
Definitely less than Michael does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was really great. The opera itself, I mean, I was grateful that when we decided to do this, it had sort of training wheels on it, because this opera is very well known, and it has leached into the culture, and La Donna Mobile, you've heard before. So I was impressed with how it works, even if you're not following along in the little
surtitles.
On the back of the chair in front of you, you can see a translation. And for the first, I would say, 15 minutes, my eyes were shuttling down all the time because I didn't want to miss a thing. Then you realize that the music itself is doing the work of telling this story. So if two characters are in conflict, you're going to hear it. If two characters are in love, you're going to hear it. So much of this is being done, because something Trey mentioned is that in opera, the composer is the thing, and the lyricist is, you know, like, he comes along a little bit later. So a lot of the heavy lifting is really being done by the music.
Well, not necessarily later. I mean, a lot of people work as teams, or, you know, the composer will work from a libretto that has been assembled for him by a librettist. But the composer is paramount. In the theater, the playwright is king. Mm-hmm. And in the opera, the composer is the one who is at the center of everything.
Yeah, and we talked quite a bit with the folks at the Metropolitan Opera, and specifically with Mary Jo, about some of the kind of myths around opera that make it seem impenetrable to people. And I want to talk specifically about a couple of those things. Glenn mentioned the translation that ran on the little tiny baby screens on the front of the seats in front of you at this particular house. Other places they appear above the stage. I had the same experience as Glenn, that they didn't seem entirely necessary in a literal sense. And I also feel like one of the myths around opera is that it will be hard to follow because it is in a language that you don't speak. And I just want to say, if you can follow a foreign film with subtitles, you can follow an opera perfectly fine in most productions that you're going to run into. And as I mentioned in the intro, this was a production that is set in 60s Vegas. It's still Rigoletto. It's not, they haven't like changed the music, but the set and the setting are 60s Vegas. So you have a lot of neon, and it's kind of a casino hotel is where most of it is going down. And the translations, the titles are not literal. They're not literally word for word. They are an English language version that's consistent with that setting. So it would say, for example, "Someone took my baby away." That's not what it says in the Verdi opera. It doesn't say "Someone took my baby away."
It's very Rat Pack slang.
Yeah,
it's Rat Pack slang because they're trying to give you an English language version that's not a literal translation of the words. It's a feel. They're trying to give you a narration that helps you follow what's going on.
Well, in a sense, all I want to know is what is the emotion being expressed on the stage, because I don't want to look away from that stage too often. And I had the same experience Glenn did, and I'm sure a lot of, I'm a first-time opera goer, obviously. I appreciated the fact that you can get into the rhythms of when the sentiment is being expressed on those screens. They also, opera has a lot of repetition. You know, when they are repeating a line, they don't put it on that screen to compel you to look up and drink in the visuals on stage.
There are places where they just pull the titles because you don't need them.
Right.
They pull them either because they're repeating a line, but I think they also pull them sometimes when they've given you the gist, and they want you to watch.
They've
and
given
so
you the gist in about eight lines,
yeah.
And those people are going to sing those eight lines for the next 6 minutes.
Or similar lines.
Once you have
the gist, they pull the titles so that you will look at the stage, which I think is a very, very smart way to go about that.
When the soprano was saying to her beau that she loves him and the flower of my innocence, etc., that goes on for a while because they want to give the music some time to kind of resonate with you, and also they want to let these people show off. They have great voices,
right? And they don't want you to be sitting there watching the screen the whole time. It's not meant to be taken in that way, and I very much appreciated that because
that was my instinct.
Yeah, I think you get the language from the listening to the singing. You get the feel of the language, and all you need to know. Stephen mentioned wanting to know the emotion. Also, I would say sometimes little plot details. Yeah. Like I actually want to know if somebody says, "Oh, I just came from over there and I saw this guy." I want to know who it is, and I want to be able to follow that part. But then I don't need every single individual thing translated for me. So one of the things I found about this was it was more similar to other theater that I am more familiar with than I expected.
Well, it helps that this production was staged by the Broadway director, Michael Mayer. And, you know, it's not the first time the Met has worked with a Broadway director. They work with Broadway directors. They work with film directors. They work with all sorts of people, including sort of more traditionally trained, you know, European arty-farty stage directors. Yes, this plays like a thriller because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's based on a Victor Hugo novel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the plot that Linda described with all these men sort of toying with these less powerful women, they're not celebrating these men. It's a morality tale. Mm-hmm. The Victor Hugo original is actually about the dangers of the abuse of great power. It's about a king, not a duke. And it's a little worse, like it's darker even than Rigoletto is.
A lot of taunting in this particular opera. The plot is driven into motion by cruel taunting.
Toxic masculinity, I'm telling you. And I say that, you know, very often when people say toxic masculinity, it's becoming a bit of a punchline in talking about everything coming down to that. But that is, in fact, what this opera is about.
Yes.
It is about ownership of women. And I think that, you know, one interesting thing about this is that for the most part, this is an opera of several men and one woman.
Right.
And it was interesting to hear, we had a conversation during one of the intermissions, or two intermissions. This was presented in three acts with two intermissions. We had a conversation about the fact that the men's voices, the baritones in particular, the lower men's voices, not the basses, but the sort of middle low, are the ones that sound the most kind of grumbly, typical opera, and are the least easy for me to hook into musically, whereas women's voices that are sort of she's a soprano.
Rosa Faola is who we're talking about.
Yeah,
well, I found her voice radiant.
Who plays a character called Gilda?
Absolutely, so beautiful to listen to, and that's just my ear is more trained for that.
Yeah, I gotta say, I went into this worried because I mean, for me, when I hear sopranos just on snippets of opera, whatever, it can sound very shrill to me. But this was the exact. Maybe it was the house. Of course, it was her. Just a richness to notes that high. It's not something I've encountered before.
I think if you ever get an opportunity to hear an actual soprano in an opera live
singing
doing those
unamplified
exactly.
in a 4,000 seat house.
Because nothing in the Metropolitan Opera House is amplified. They will emphatically make sure there are no microphones for anybody. Everybody has to sing over the orchestra. They have their own orchestra down in the orchestra pit. And they explained to us that because of the number of productions that they put on, they can't really borrow musicians. You know, we talked to them about the fact that they can't really borrow musicians from other places. So in addition to everything else that they have going on, they basically run an orchestra.
They run a world-class orchestra.
Yeah. And so if you ever get a chance to hear something like that, an unamplified, brilliant soprano, it is a special thing. And I do think it gave me better insight into why. I won't claim to have had like the Pretty Woman experience where she begins bawling and says, "I love opera forever." But I understand better why people love it the way that they do than I did before I saw it live, which makes sense, right? Like, it makes sense that that would be true, but it is true.
I had a very similar reaction. And one thing that I would say to the skeptical future opera viewer.
Or nervous
future opera viewer. You know, we went in, oh man, it's a 3.5-hour Italian clown opera. this is going to somehow feel punishing in some way, like better, you know, kind of the way people talked about going into the Avengers, like, oh my God, how are we going to sit through a 3-hour movie? It flew by. Mm-hmm. And part of it...
Also, it's 3.5 hours with 2 half-hour intermissions.
That's exactly...
Time for drinks and sandwiches.
That's exactly right. And I got to say, coming out of that first act, which really breezed by, the last thing you see is George Gednidze, who plays Rigoletto, bellowing, and you see on the screen the words with, you know, exclamation points and everything. It's the curse! And man, I was just like, yeah! And then it was intermission.
Yeah.
And so...
Fist pumping.
The second act felt like it was about 5 minutes long.
Right.
Because I was still just on that
high. Just so pumped. And it was funny because we were talking during that intermission about the fact that Stephen was now going to apply this to everything. It was going to be like, oh, they don't have what I want at the grocery store. It's the curse!
What, still water instead of sparkling?
Did you know that The Curse was the original title of Rigoletto?
I did not.
The Maledizione.
Okay. I was going to ask you what the Italian word before it was.
There is a man who puts a curse on Rigoletto.
Yes.
And so Rigoletto
Because Rigoletto has been taunting him.
Exactly.
Now, in fairness, Rigoletto is the court jester. His job is to taunt people.
Right. And it is true that when you remove this from an actual court to a Vegas casino,
right,
it's more unclear,
yes,
that it's his job.
He's no longer the licensed court jester. He's just Joey Bishop.
Can you talk to me a little bit, Trey, about the modern state of opera, right? I assume new operas are still written regularly.
Oh, absolutely. There are, and the other thing is, we went to the Metropolitan Opera, and we're talking about this massive institution with dozens of shows every year, hundreds of performances of those shows.
By far the biggest operation in the country.
Probably in the world.
Right.
And it's a monstrous budget, something like $300 million.
Yeah.
And
I joked at the end of our tour that I was getting all the information I needed to start a rival opera company.
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
There are 150 professional opera companies that are members of the trade association, Opera America. They are large and small. They do dozens of performances a year, or they do five. There are operas based on Dead Man Walking and A Streetcar Named Desire. So there's tons of contemporary opera. If you don't like the old stuff, you might like the new stuff.
Mm-hmm. We all spoke about sort of not feeling sure what the cultural feel of opera would be for us. Like, what were we supposed to wear? What would the vibe be like? Look, the Metropolitan Opera in New York is a sort of a traditionally what you would think that crowd would look like,
mm-hmm,
right? It's an older crowd. It's a relatively well-off crowd, I think. It's quite a white crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that varies somewhat wherever you go. But at the same time, we went to a matinee on a weekend. But I don't think it should be something that should feel any more kind of culturally foreign to anybody, yeah, than going to a Broadway show is, because you can fit in fine. You know, if you can go to a Broadway show and feel comfortable, you can go to this and feel comfortable. I didn't think there was really any barrier in that way. I didn't feel uncomfortable or unwelcome.
But that not knowing is something that opera has to grapple with. The fact that I didn't grow up in an opera household,
right,
so it is foreign to me. Trey, did you find opera on your own, or was it around you growing up?
My mom took me to a kid's performance of the Augusta Opera Company in Augusta, Georgia, where they left the curtain up as they changed scenes. And we were sitting in the front row of the mezzanine, and I was fascinated by the stagecraft.
Sure.
But also, I think this was Lucia de Lammermoor. Like, my mom threw me in the deep end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it from the beginning.
See, that's it. I do think there's something to that. It is a cultural thing. And the last thing we should address, I suppose, is price. The Met folks are very clear to tell us over and over again that there are cheap seats, that there are $25 seats, there are same-day seats or student seats, but it is a barrier to entry.
As it is with Broadway.
Yeah.
As it is with Broadway. Right. We've talked about sort of the fact that with Broadway, it's price, but it's not only price. And it's the same way with the opera audience and the Broadway audience being very white. There may be a price element of those things, but as our friend Gene Demby has often pointed out, Black audiences will pay plenty of money to go to the things that are welcoming and important to them. And I think that the Metropolitan Opera is dealing with a lot of the same things that a lot of arts organizations are and that a lot of other organizations are, right? They're talking a lot about how do we continue to bring people to opera when they may feel both an economic barrier and also just kind of like it doesn't come to you naturally. If like Glenn said, if you weren't raised with it, how do you find it? And I think for a lot of people, Broadway comes to them through something like Hamilton or a cast album that they listen to. But I'm not sure that opera has found those bridges yet. But I would encourage anybody to go check it out. If you like a museum or you like a fun, new, interesting experience, like there's nothing about this that should feel like it's going to be, hard to get into.
The Met has stagings of opera that you can see at many different movie theaters where they will schedule screenings of the opera that you can go to the movie theater and experience a pretty
sophisticated
facsimile of the opera going experience. You're not obviously hearing a live voice in the room, but you're hearing it through a pretty nice sound system. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know what the opera is like, it has, I would argue, never been easier
100%.
To find out.
So we want to hear about your experiences with opera, how you think about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our opera show. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And of course, thanks to all of you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Thanks to the Metropolitan Opera for hosting us. If you have a second and you're so inclined, subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here on Friday.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics Podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics Podcast.
Subscribe!